mighty, walk before me and be blameless. I will confirm my covenant between me and you and will greatly increase your numbers. Abram fell face down, and God said to him, as for me, this is my covenant with you. You will be the father of many nations. No longer will you be called Abram. Your name will be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings will come from you. I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. The whole land of Canaan, where you are now an alien, I will give you as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God. Then God said to Abraham, as for you, you must keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, for the generations to come. This is my covenant with you and your descendants after you, the covenant you are to keep. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You are to undergo circumcision, and it will be the sign of the covenant between you and me, between me and you. For the generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised, including those born in your household or bought with money from a foreigner, those who are not your offspring. Whether born in your household or bought with your money, they must be circumcised. My covenant in your flesh is to be an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who has not been circumcised in the flesh will be cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant. God also said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of people will come from her. Abram fell face down. He laughed. And he said to himself, will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? And Abram said to God, if only Ishmael might live under your blessing. Then God said, yes, but your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call him Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. I will surely bless him. I will make him fruitful and will greatly increase his numbers. He will be the father of 12 rulers, and I will make him into a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you, by this time next year. When he had finished speaking with Abraham, God went up from him. On that very day, Abram took his son Ishmael and all those born in his household or bought with his money, every male in his household, and circumcised them as God had told him. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised, and his son Ishmael was 13. Abraham and his son Ishmael were both circumcised on the same day, and every male in Abraham's household, including those born in his household or bought from a foreigner, was circumcised with him. This is the word of the Lord. This is a story about having a deep and profound relationship with God. There are a lot of questions that come when you think about having a relationship with God. For example, will God have a relationship with me? Let's start with that. Would God want to have a relationship with me? If I enter into a relationship, what happens if I turn my back on God? Will he accept me back? Or, perhaps more poignantly, what if I make a mess out of my life? What if I make wrong decisions? Can I count on God to still make promises to me if I'm in a relationship with him? Well, these are pertinent to the life of Abraham, because Abraham is someone who is in a relationship with God. Abraham is now someone who has, in many cases, believed and trusted God, has been faithful to God, but at the same time, someone who's turned his back on God, who's failed to believe God, and has made some rather horrific mistakes, as we saw last week much of the headlines we read about in the Middle East, the animosity that you read about in your paper goes back to Abraham not believing God. Basically, being promised a son, being unwilling to believe that God would give him a son through his wife, taking matters into his own hands, taking a maidservant and having a child with her. And it was an action that had incredible long-term disastrous consequences. So here we are beyond that story by 13 years. The story we read last week of Abram and Hagar. Abram is 86 years old. It's getting difficult to believe these promises of God. He takes things into his own hands, only to have God say, "Trust me." And now Abram is 99 years old, and it would stand to reason that he still is questioning in his mind, "Do I have a future in God's plans? Given my life, given my mistakes, given what's gone before, do I have a future in God's plans?" And what this story tells us, and I want you to hear this, is that there's always a plan for you. There's always a future for you in God's plans. Now, and it's because of the kind of relationship Abram has. What I want us to do is look at this text to try to understand this relationship that you really can trust. And the first thing I want you to see about it is that this relationship has to be understood as a covenant relationship. And that's not a word, you may have heard that word battered about here and there, but it's not a word that we use commonly, because it's really not something that's part of our culture. I want to talk to you about what we mean when we say that it is a covenant relationship. A couple of weeks ago, our congregation looked at Genesis 15 and the covenant that God originally made with Abraham, the one that is being renewed now in Genesis 17 with the sign of circumcision. Now, what is a covenant? Now, this is very far in the distance to us, but in the ancient Near East, This was the way business was done. This was as common as flipping on CNN and hearing the stock market reports. You know, it was the way business was done. It was the way people thought. It was just like opening up the Wall Street Journal and checking your stock. I mean, that's just the way they made deals. They literally cut deals. The word covenant means to cut. It's a Hebrew word, berit, a covenant, a cutting. And actually, it made total sense if you think about it. And it usually existed, covenants existed between a strong party and a lesser, less powerful party as a way to work things out in a mutually beneficial way. Now, think about this. Why cutting? Well, it made a lot of sense. You know, we have hundreds and hundreds of these treaties. Covenants were not invented in the Bible. This is something that was just part of ordinary culture, and God enters into something that is part of human culture as a means of communicating his commitment to relationship. But we have hundreds of these, and if you look at these ancient Hittite covenants that follow these same patterns you see in Genesis, what you see basically is a suzerain, or a great powerful king, making a deal with a vassal, a suzerain and a vassal, a lesser powerful king, and they kill an animal. They cut it in pieces and put some of the animal over here and some of the animal over here. Now, the powerful king, you cut a deal. Maybe it's about trade. Maybe it's about borders, something like that, or drinking water rights, this sort of thing. You cut the deal by cutting the animal. And the great king walks through it and says, "Oh, may I be cut in pieces like this animal if I don't keep my bargain." And then the little impy vassal walks through and says the same formula, "May I be cut in pieces." Now, of course, written between the lines is, we really know who's going to be cut in pieces here if the treaty is not kept. And that's kind of the point about all the blood and guts, you see. It's a great way to seal a contract. Who needs lawyers when you got dead animals? That's just kind of the way they looked at it in the ancient Near East. Shed a little blood. Cut the covenant. Trust me. They'll hear what you're saying. So it's a bond in blood that is administered by someone with power. What I want you to see here is that the relationship that a covenant creates is based on surrender of control. If a weaker king had entered into a covenant with a let's say you had a little tribe somewhere in the ancient Near East, and the king of Assyria said, all right, we're going to negotiate a caravan route. You would not say in this relationship, well, we're not sure if that's where we're at right now. Or, you know, I'm just not sure that this kind of formal relationship is going to work for me. Why? Because your head would be on a pole before you finished your sentence and, you know, the rest of your body set to the four corners of the empire. That's the kind of thing they did back in the good old days. You know, you are about to enter a relationship where you surrender control of your life. You are entering a relationship where you recognize the authority of the other. And notice that this is the form, and you just need to see this. This is the kind of relationship God chooses to articulate the nature of his relationship with Abram. God initiates it. It is not a negotiable relationship. It's not a relationship that is determined by what Abram is looking for. And notice the difference. I mean, this biblical concept is very foreign to the idea of spirituality that's common today. What I'm looking for in religion, or what I'm really looking for in God, is so God could be interviewed. And so there were options out there that could be legitimate. Now, don't get me wrong. There are churches on every corner of this town, virtually, that will sell you a different God, that will sell you a different Jesus, that will basically give you exactly what you're looking for or what you think you might like. But the question is it the real God? Well, I think we need to be taken by, in this story of Abram and the God who is a covenant God, is that the real God makes demands. There are two errors that you see as you read through the book of Genesis about the way human beings look at God, that the covenant relationship challenges. First of all, we tend to think that God is like us. We tend to think that God is like us, just intuitively, instinctively. God must be like me. He wants all the elections to go the way I want them to go. He wants culture to be the way I want it to be. God is like me. That is a very, very, very ancient human, simple way of thinking. The prophet Isaiah, in chapter 55 of his prophecy, there's a direct word from God that challenges every person, where God says, you know what? My thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. My thoughts are higher than your thoughts. My ways are higher than your ways. In fact, as high as the heavens are above the earth, so are my thoughts above your thoughts, and my ways above your ways. This runs deeply counter to the way human beings are wired. We just assume that God is like us. But you see, if God were just like us, religion would just be a projection. Which is one of the great claims about faith, isn't it? You're just projecting what you want to see out there. A true God who is different than us, not just the great cosmic dewdrop dripping through all things, but a God who has created a personal universe with individual persons in it, who is himself a person with a will and a mind of his own, is necessarily other than we are. Not a projection of us. Otherwise, life would just be a maze without a center. You know, that is, G.K. Chesterton talks about atheism, and he says, why is atheism our worst nightmare? Because atheism posits the idea that the maze we all live in of life, all the questions, all that, is actually a maze without a center. It's just a maze. That's all reality will ever be for you, is a maze. Get used to it. There's no blob of cheese. You're just in the maze. But don't you see, if religion is just a projection of who you are and what you want, you're still in the maze. The only alternative is the covenant alternative, which is there is a home at the center of the maze. There is a reality at the center of the maze that you can come to, that you can ground yourself in. But you have to count the cost. You have to realize that home that you come to, that reality that you enter into, if you come to the true and living God, is other than you are. He has a will but will cross your will. And boy, does he make demands. There's an absolute center, ultimate reality. In fact, the name of God given in the Bible, the name that God reveals himself by, Yahweh. We're not sure of its pronunciation, but what scholars do know about that name, sometimes translated Jehovah, is a third-person rendering of I am. He is. That when Israel talked about God, the most fundamental thing they could say about it is, he's there. He is. He's real. In the words of Francis Schaeffer, he is there and he is not silent. We think God is like us, though. That's an error. And secondly, because we think that way, we just think we have a right to be accepted by God. God must be like me. I judge everything by what I think he's like. And I just assume that surely he will accept me. This is how things were at the beginning, if we read this book of Genesis. We were accepted by God. We were in God's presence. We walked with him in the cool of the garden. But this issue of thinking that we could determine what was right and wrong for our lives, that we could be our own Lord, that we could be our own sovereign, was in fact the root of what got us kicked out of that state. Man was kicked out of the garden for that very reason. I could be autonomous. I could determine. I can be a self-determining entity. We're out of the garden, and yet the mindset still doesn't go away. You know where you see it? You see it in Cain. Cain and his brother Abel. They bring sacrifices. And it just, Cain cannot get over, read Genesis 4, if you read that story, Cain just cannot get over the fact, where does God get off not accepting my sacrifice? In other words, the way I am, the way I think, the way I'm ordered, the way I bring myself to God, if God were any kind of God of it all, he would be pleased, he'd be grateful, and he'd accept it. And one of the hardest things that we have to get into our hearts to deal with this God of the covenant is that he determines what's acceptable. He determines the relationship. And that determination may, in fact, run counter to some of your deepest convictions. It may run counter to some of your deepest instincts. Now, Abram is different. Here's Abram, having a relationship renewed with God here in Genesis 17. I want you to notice about this that Abram in no way is taking his confidence in the fact that he has done what he ought to do. In fact, Abram is fully cognizant that at many of the turns in his life, he's taken the wrong turn. At many of the turns in his life, he's failed to trust God. He's failed to believe God. He's aware of his brokenness. He's aware of his sin. But his confidence and his trust comes of what he's seeing in the character of God. That God is faithful. God is merciful. And this relationship is coming from God. Just what I want you to see second. All right, this is a covenant relationship. It's one that is determined by the God who is there. It's an absolute relationship from an absolute person who demands absolute loyalty and obedience. So secondly, it's a relationship that changes you. And Abram is prepared to be changed. It's a covenant relationship, and secondly, it is a relationship that, if entered into, will absolutely change you. The poet W.H. Auden once ruminated, we would rather be ruined than changed. Nobody wants to be changed, really, Auden is saying. And I noticed in church growth books, you know, you read various books about how to communicate in the church. And one of the things I pick up looking at those books is don't talk about change. Don't say to people that they need to be changed or say to a community that you want to change anything. That looks very negative. And yet, if you look at the scriptures, one of the clear requirements, as well as one of the clear promises, is change. Abram knows his sin. He sees his need. He sees the grace of God condescending to him to draw him into deeper relationship. And what I want you to see is that he responds in faith. Why? You see, if there's a God coming to you in a covenant to basically cut the animal and say, all right, I determine all things. I am Lord. That is the nature of this relationship. You know, I'm God and you're not. We're not dialogue partners. I'm God. You're my creature. You're my child. Now, Abram trusts God Why? Because Abram sees that his truest self is to be found in relationship to this all-demanding God. And I think this is one of the fundamental questions a person has to ask yourself. Is obedience to God, is trust in God, the path to the truest self I am? You see, Abram knows that he has been made in relationship to God. The book of Genesis teaches that human beings were created in the image of God. That is, that we were like God and made to know God in a relationship of love, and really can never even know who we are. You can never know who you're created to be until you're in that covenant relationship. Something will always be wrong. The way you see yourself, the way you see your relationships, the experience you have in your career, whatever it is, it will never be quite right. Because one of the most fundamental aspects of your personality, namely the image of God, of being created to flourish in relationship with your Creator, is gone and is missing. Now, there's a couple of ways to think about that relationship. Let me give an example. When you talk about image, it can be a tricky concept. Think of a coin. All right, a coin might have an image of the president on it. So there's a relationship between that president and that coin. All right, but the president is usually dead. Generally, I'm not aware of any living presidents on coinage. So you see, there's not necessarily this vital, ongoing relationship between that person being president and the coin. You see, the image is indelible on the coin. But think of a more clear, beautiful image. Think of the moon reflecting at night on a lake. You see the lake, the moon is full. There are no clouds, and there's no wind. And you look out into the lake, and there's a relationship now between the moon and the lake, so that you begin to see the glory of the moon in relationship to the water. Right? But when the clouds come, when the wind begins to blow the water, a relationship begins to falter, and ultimately can disappear completely. Well, that is what happened to humanity. You see, the clouds of our sin, the winds of our own ego, have ruffled the image of God, have broken the relationship with God, so that our truest self doesn't shine out. What we were created to be isn't fully known or experienced. And so we don't experience the life of God. Now, Abram is open to it because he believes his truest self is found in that relationship. And notice how personally and radically the demands go and how radical the change is. God actually changes his name. It doesn't get much more personal than that. God actually changes his name. You know what? I've only known one person in my life who changed his name. I had a friend in New York who changed his name legally 3 times. Spent a lot of money to do it. And I only found out about it. He had kind of an interesting name. My wife and I were going to their apartment in Brooklyn one day. I looked on his mailbox, and there were 3 names there because he was still getting mail from all of his previous names. I'll never forget. His last name had been Emmanuel Cosmo. And I think his wife just said, this is just not going to go. Spend the money and get another one. So he got a third name. Very unusual for a person to change their name. And yet here is God changing Abram's name. Now, in these ancient treaties of the covenant, this was actually one of the things the great king would often do. He would say, now we have this relationship over the caravan route, and by the way, from now on, you're Bobby. Now, why is that? Well, don't you see? It's an amazing way to express power and control, to rename someone. It's not an impersonal thing. It's not a minor thing. It's not a matter of, the small writing in a contract somewhere. It's at the deepest level of who you are is affected by this relationship. And that's what's happening with Abram. And notice his name. His name has probably always been a source of pain. Here's a man, at this point, 99 years old, who has one child, illegitimately, really, and his name all of his life has meant Exalted Father. Abram exalted Father. Can you just imagine? And the point is that the language of the people of the time, people going, oh, hello, exalted father, when the man has, he really doesn't have any legitimate heirs. And now God, before giving him his heir, changes his name to father of many, Abraham, father of many, Sarah, mother of nations. This is really a relationship that is stretching their faith, because now, you know, imagine with all their friends. I've changed my name. What did he change it to? Well, God changed it, actually. Yeah, right. What did he change it to? Well, actually, he changed it to father of many. He's 99 years old. Deep personal invasion into their life. Here's a couple. Who knows how long they've been married? You know, I don't know who would have been married longest in this congregation. I'm going to take a guess. This would be Earl Whitmer. But can you imagine Earl coming home to Marguerite? This is, you know, a couple that's been married many, many years in our couple, in our church, and saying to his wife, you know, from now on, call me Emmanuel Cosmo. I mean, you know, you just imagine trying to work that into your life, having your name changed. At 99, I mean, you would never get used to it. I mean, this is a long time to have a pattern. But every time they heard it, they were reminded anew that God's claim on me is all consuming. I know there's some of you, you've heard that claim. You've read the Bible, you've heard Jesus claim to pick up a cross and follow him, and that's a frightening thing. But don't you see, Abram and Sarah, I think they probably, you know, if it had been modern day, they would have embroidered their name on everything, on their jeans, on their shirt, everything. Why? Because that all-embracing claim represented God's love, God's purpose, and God's promise to bless them. And that's really what faith comes down to. Faith comes down to, yes, understanding that it is an all-consuming relinquishment. I must acknowledge your lordship, and I can't look at the area of a bad marriage or the area of my money or the area of my sexuality or the area of my past and how difficult it would be to forgive people or ever change some of the things about me that I feel are just so essential for me to be who I am. You see, you allow God to name you when you truly begin to believe that he loves you. But that's what he does. Now, that's my question to you. If you're here today, maybe you're not a Christian. Would you be willing to let God name you? Would you be willing to come to him with all of your issues, all your past? And you know, today in our culture, it can be nationality, it can be politics, it can be sexuality, it can be gender, all these things that people look to say, this is who I am. And God will not, you know what, you may be created, and those may be aspects of who you are, but you do not bring it to the table. You come and he says, I name you. You don't name me. Are you willing to let him name you? You know, circumcision, baptism in the New Testament. You know, what happens at baptism? You're baptized into the name of God. You literally, at that moment, are now officially called by another name. You receive the name of God. You're baptized into the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit. Being a Christian means nothing less that's saying, I am willing to let God name me. Because God makes people new. He doesn't make them better. Now, I have a word for Christians this morning. And it's this. And Christians, you hear that and you say, yes, well, I've taken God's name. I've trusted Christ. I've said he's my Lord. But let me ask you, how seriously do you honestly take being named? The claim of the covenant on you. Is the Lordship of Christ penetrating deeply into your life more and more? Are you experiencing it not just in what you don't do, but in what you do? When I was in seminary in Philadelphia, I had a friend, a pastor who had a great impact on me and a lot of other people named Jack Miller. And there was a question he would periodically ask his congregation. He would say to them, and Christian friends, I think this is just a great diagnostic question for yourself. When was the last time you didn't do something purely because you love Jesus? When was the last time you actually did something purely and simply because you love Jesus? What's he saying? Is his lordship sweet to you? Is the fact that he names you and an all-consuming demand comes to you and says, take up a cross, call me Lord, has that become your joy? Is it driving you? You know, Jesus encountered the Pharisees, and I see a lot of them in me and in other people I talk to. Because the way the Pharisees saw their lives were, you know, there are some big issues, some big lines I never cross. You know, I don't cheat on my taxes. I don't commit adultery. I don't do these other things. But I am allowed to have this inner life that's different. I can think about things. I can fantasize about things. I can do things and cut around the edges because of what's in my heart. And Jesus said, don't you understand? You're just as guilty as the person who's doing it. Why is he saying that? Because I want you. I want to be your Lord. You either are filling your heart with those things or you're filling your heart with me and you're finding it to be enough. Is the love of God that, you see, Abram wasn't somebody who was weak. He wasn't somebody who just said, you know what, I need a tyrant in my life. Nobody wants a tyrant in their life. And Abram opened his life to a lover. And that's ultimately what a covenant relationship is. Yes, it's absolute, and yes, it changes you. But the reason you open your heart to it, you begin to see that this is the person who made me. And this is the person who loves me more than I will ever love myself. This isn't just an issue for someone considering coming to faith. It's a daily question for anybody who's a Christian. You know, the other day I was driving downtown here in Atlanta, and I saw that they're building a new Federal Reserve Bank, which is pretty interesting to see. Years ago, I went to the Federal Reserve in New York and took the tour. And you can't see this anymore now, but in the olden days when you took the tour, they would take you down and show you all the gold in the basement, which is a very cool thing to see, you know, a few billion dollars worth of gold. And then they had another floor where they shredded all the old money. You know what they do? The banks take the currency out, you know, and if it's got a little mark, a tatter, you know, a little tea stain on there or something, they just start pulling the cash. They replace it with new cash. They send it to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve shreds it. And I had somebody say to me, and they said, you know, I would be willing to pay $50 if they just let me push a button to shred some of that cash. Wouldn't you love to do that? And I immediately said, absolutely not. Because you know what? If it was me, I don't care if there were guards everywhere, I'd be trying to figure out how can I hang on to some of this cash. No, please don't shred it. He said, even though I know, they're replacing it with nice, clean money, better money, I still see the potency of currency there. And you see, this is what Christians do with the Lordship of Christ. We say we're in covenant. We say we know the way to blessing. We know that dying to ourselves is the way to find ourselves and truest life, but there are certain aspects of our life that we hang on to because we know. We instinctively believe we don't really want, we say we struggle, which is an evangelical code word for something I don't want to change in my life. Because we still think the currency will pay. Responding to the Lordship of Christ. Is it costly? Yes. You know what this text says about Abraham? When God told him this, what did Abraham do? It literally says in the original, he fell on his face laughing. Yes! Sometimes the demands of following Jesus are going to evoke strong responses. You want to fall on your face laughing or crying or screaming. But he responded. Now, let me just say one last thing about this. This text shows us that this kind of covenant relationship, embracing the love of God in an all-consuming way, is made possible only in Jesus Christ. I have to say a word about all we just read about, namely circumcision. I mean, let's face it, if we're talking about a personal relationship, this is a sign that gets, well, about as personal as you can get. It's made with men and sons, but women are fully included in the covenant community. Thankfully, unlike many other Eastern civilizations, women were not cut as part of this covenant. But I think there was also a symbol that God wanted men and women to see in the cutting. What would it be? We see circumcision took place around the organ of generation. The place that everyone knew, they didn't understand DNA, But they knew that this is where life comes from. They know that this is where it begins. Life begins with this origin. And right there is the most personal aspect of the beginning of life. You see God bringing a sign of judgment, a shedding of blood, a saying that unless life comes up to my standards, it will be cut off for me. If I am holy, unless life comes up to my standards, unless you live to be what I created you to be. Remember, the moon and the water, fully glorious as I am glorious. Unless you come up to here, move the night just a little bit and you'll get the idea. You'll be completely cut off. It's a very, let me tell you something. God has said to communicate. That communicates. It's a way of saying also, why is bloodshed? Because Abram, you can't produce a life. The life I'm promising you, the seed that's coming, you really can't produce the life I'm calling. And that's why Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of circumcision. This is, you know, that's the hard thing to think about, circumcision. You know, you go home and say, what'd you talk about today? Ooh, circumcision. But you know what? For a Christian, it's one of the most beautiful pictures you'll ever see. Because what we realize is, you know what? We're not moralists who punish ourselves so that God will appreciate us, or people who constantly do good works just so that we hope God will accept us. We are people who believe that there was another person in our place who was completely, utterly, and totally cut off. Jesus Christ was circumcised on the eighth day, that he also bore another circumcision, and that he was finally judged and blood was shed, that he went to the cross in my place and the place of all those who come to him and believe. And in his resurrection, don't you see, as we come to him in faith now, the risen Christ, and the Holy Spirit comes into our life, we begin then, him in and through us, to live the life that God requires. And only in that will you ever know this life that God demands and that God also supplies. Abram heard the demands and he laughed out loud. But you know what the verse also says about him? When he heard God call, it says that very day, he went and circumcised himself and Ishmael. And that's the call to us. No matter where you are, the call to relationship is one, no matter how it affects you, whether you laugh out loud, respond. Let's pray. Lord, may we see you as Abram saw you, as a God of grace and love, a God whose love is what we long for, whose fullness is where the very idea of fullness comes from, whose beauty is where the very longing of beauty comes from. May we know that the way up is down, that the way to live is to die, that the way to find freedom is to surrender to the one who made us. Lord, you know our hearts. Draw us to yourself, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.